the Township of McKellar regular meeting of council for October 21st, 2025 to order. Start with roll call.
Counselor Marley Haskell.
Counselor Debbie Zula.
Counselor Nick Ryland.
Counselor Mike Hakanen.
Clerk Administrator Carly Britton.
Deputy Clerk Mary Smith.
Did you say your name?
Oh. Bylaw Chris Cazola.
Mayor David Moore. Any declarations of pecuniary and or personal interest in the general nature thereof? Hearing none, I have resolution 25-443, moved by Councilor Ryland, second by Councilor Kekkonen. Be resolved, the Council of Corporation of the Township of McKellar, is hereby approve the agenda for this regular meeting of council as amended to remove items 5.1 and 5.2 and to move item 17.3 to precede item 11.1. Clear with everyone. Any discussion? Call the question. All those in favor? None opposed? Carried. In the spirit of reconciliation and cooperation, we wish to acknowledge that the land on which we gather is the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and the Mississauga people. Its boundaries fall within the Robinson-Huron Treaty of 1850 and the Williams Treaty of 1923. We are grateful to live here, and we thank all the generations of people who have taken care of this land for thousands of years. To honor the suffering of Indigenous people and the love and wisdom they have carried for thousands of years, we pledge to work in community and harmony with each other and the environment we inhabit and work towards truth and reconciliation. Resolution 25, before she speaks, I guess, -444, moved by Councilor Zulak, second by Councilor Haskin. Be resolved, the Council of the Corporation of the Township of McKellar does hereby receive report bylaw 2025-04, bylaw enforcement activity report March 2025 to September 2025, from bylaw enforcement officer Chris Kasulke for information purposes. Okay, Chris, if you want to just summarize, I guess everybody has a copy, but.
Yeah, okay, well, that's fine. Good evening. Yeah, in total there were 54 calls, and that's a combination of just inquiries or concerns, or if you want to call them complaints. Most of them were focused on dogs running at large or being aggressive, and I addressed that in more detail in the report, that really, you know, hands are somewhat tied when there's no bylaw to enforce, and also I don't have authority to enforce the Dog Owner Liability Act when it comes to the aggressive dogs. But overall, honestly, there weren't too many concerns around that. Burning was another one, and that really ramped up in September for some reason. It was fairly quiet through the main summer months, so everyone was really abiding by the rules, especially when we were under a high rating. But it seemed like in September, all of a sudden, everyone was starting to burn their debris, and they were doing it without permits. So that kind of seemed to be the heavy focus in September. The road allowance was something that came up more than I expected, where there was just a lot of inquiries around what are you allowed to do on the road allowance, how far does it go, where does my property line end, all of those things. So those are kind of the three heavy hitters for the season. But overall, I have to say, any of the concerns that came in, the vast majority I was able to solve simply with educating people on how the bylaw is to be interpreted. And I gained compliance pretty much very promptly from anyone who had an actual official complaint against them. So overall, I think the season went quite well in that regard.
Excellent.
So I don't know if you have any questions for me that I can answer for you that I didn't already address?
They usually do. Councilor Kekkonen?
Yeah, so thanks for the report. Excellent to be filled in what's going on. You mentioned that you're not able to do anything in regards to aggressive dogs through DOLA. Previous bylaw enforcement officers did gain sort of control of situations through DOLA. So what's the difference now?
Right. I think it may just be, so when I did my research to figure out where my authority ends, it did become quite clear that I would need a specific authority given to me by counsel to say that, yes, you can enforce DOLA. Without that, I really don't have the authority to do that.
It's always looking through DOLA, and then it does give authority to, it gives a definition of peace officers in section 12, and it does mention that a municipal law enforcement officer is a peace officer under the Act.
Right, and I don't have all of the act in front of me, of course, but I can look into it a little deeper. But I know from even speaking with, as I mentioned in my report, I have a contact of a bylaw enforcement manager who has a whole team under her and verified with her. And yes, there needs to be an actual specific instruction by council to say, yes, we want you to enforce it. Now, again, I can take another deeper dive into it. There's really no contact person that I can reach out to in regards to DOLA. It's just a legislation that exists, and it does come down to interpretation. So it may be as simple as we just have to put something in writing to make it really specific, and then I would be more comfortable. The other piece to that, of course, is that to deal with aggressive dog, I would need to have the specialized training. Because if I were to try and seize a dog that's being aggressive and I do it the wrong way and I'm not trained properly, I could do more harm than good, whether that's to the animal or myself or bystanders. So I would need to have that additional training, and you have to then think of, okay, where do I go with the dog once I've captured it? So there needs to be a connection, a collaboration with a dog pound or some kind of an organization that will be able to take in that dog until we decide what to do with it. So I think there are a lot of moving parts to that. And I have no problem doing some further research if council would like me to do that. I had been sort of under the impression that there wasn't really a huge desire to necessarily govern people's dogs in a great detail. But again, if that is something you want me to look into, I can certainly do that.
Councilor Kagan?
Just particularly because previous law enforcement officers did get control of situations in regard to aggressive dogs, which, made it unnecessary for a dog bylaw because they could deal with the situations at hand with the resources and legislation that were available to them. So I think it'd be good to be able to ensure that that is a tool that you can use. So.
Okay, I'll do some work on that and make sure that I've got all the bases covered and take another look at it. Yeah.
Thank you.
I'll connect with Tom as well because he had done it prior to me. I don't know if I can reach out to them prior to that, but yeah, I'll do some more investigating and see what I can come up with.
Okay, any other questions from council? Okay, with the chart, I'm happy with that. I think it's even good to break it down, not necessarily by the incident itself, but by the category. And then the months are broken down again, subcategory, which is good. I'm just interested in the very last, because this is showing up regularly, about the repeat complaint, about the boats, I guess, right there.
Right.
Is there anything we can do with the repeat complainer if it's not actually happening? Or do you have to respond every time?
You have to respond every time, and really at the end of the day, there is that nifty little tool, which is, it is at the end of the day up to my discretion whether I want to actually enforce a particular bylaw. If I feel that it's a nuisance complaint or simply there's not enough evidence for me to actually go after the violator, then I can be the one to say, there's nothing here, I don't have enough to act on it. And if the person continues to complain, I would just continue to give that same answer. There's really nothing beyond that. I mean, hopefully the message would be received at some point that there's just nothing there for me to go on.
Okay.
So. Mm-hmm.
The other one dealt with the, page here, but short-term rentals.
Yeah.
And there's a question about a bylaw, and then the says Carly and I responded by email to explain the township's position. I'm not trying to be facetious here, but I'd just be interested to hear what the township's position is. I have an idea, but I'm just interested in what you're telling me.
Yeah. Well, my understanding is that there was a case brought before the courts about an illegal operation of a short-term rental. And that it was tied up in the courts for a number of years, and ultimately council decided to withdraw. And based on that, it would be a waste of resources to go after any others if there's not a deep commitment by council to see it through to the end. Because then again, you're just tying up the court system and everyone's resources to go after something. So again, that's the what had been explained to me when I came on board, because I knew that this was going to come up. So I had a conversation with both Chris Bordalo and Carly to see, like, what is the position? What do I do about this? And that was basically what I was told.
You know, that was at least one, maybe two councils ago.
Yeah.
So we haven't really dealt with it, but I'm just interested in how the actual bylaws being interpreted, the zoning bylaw that talks about a commercial use for short-term rental. Is that being explained to people as well, that if they're renting their cottage, that they can't do that residentially, it has to be done commercially according to our bylaws?
Well, again, because of the fact that I was basically told there's no interest to pursue this in the courts, I really haven't pursued short-term rentals to say, hey, you can't do this. Because what do I have to follow it up with, right? I can't very well say, well, you're not allowed to do it, and then they're going to look at me and go, well, that's a cash cow for me. I'm not going to walk away. What are you going to do about it? And then I would have to say, well, I can't, right? So unless I get different, again, if there's different intention from council that they want me to move forward with, absolutely, I will do that. But the short answer, if someone, and people have asked me, you know, hey, I'm looking at buying a property. I may consider doing a short-term rental part of the time when my family isn't up here to enjoy it themselves. What are the rules around it? And I have to tell them, frankly, it's not allowed. Mm-hmm. You don't have the proper zoning. And then they're like, okay, what others are doing, I'm like, right, but I'm just here to tell you that the zoning does not allow for it, and that's kind of where it's left. Now, having said all of that, I manage another municipality as well. They do have a short-term rental bylaw. The only tool really that is there is that you know who they are. They register for a fee every year. It allows the chief building officer to go in and do an inspection to make sure that everything is up to snuff, to have a short-term rental situation, to kind of cap how many people they're allowed to host, you know, that sort of thing. So it gives the township a little bit more control over what happens on short-term rentals, and it also allows bylaw officers to be aware of where they are. So if a complaint comes in, you kind of look and go, oh, okay, that's one of our short-term rentals. So when I go to this address, I'm probably dealing with people that are just here for the week or the weekend. So not that that's a huge difference, because, you know, it's a small community. You learn pretty quickly who the short-term rentals are. But it does kind of give you a little bit more visibility on who has them. Or those that are not registered, you can then go to them and say, hey, you need to be registered. You need to do an inspection and make sure that everything kind of follows some of the rules that you would set up as council. Again, having said all of that, I really didn't get a lot of complaints. There's one situation, literally one address, that has had multiple complaints, but only by one neighbor in that area. The rest were kind of like, well, yeah, there's occasional problems, but it's gotten better over the years. I did quite a bit of work with the owner of that short-term rental this summer, who was more than cooperative and addressed every point that I raised to him that had been brought to me. And from what I can tell, it's been resolved. But overall, honestly, the complaints that came in for short-term rentals are not significant in number.
Okay, go ahead, Councillor.
So did you mention to him that, or her, whoever it was, that they need to change to commercial?
No.
Because they're not zoned for that?
No, I don't. I don't know that that came up, to tell you the truth. Yeah.
Because the people that actually have commercial business have to do the water inspections, they have to do the septic, they have to do all of this, they have to pay for a business license,
right,
and everything, and these people are paying nothing,
mm-hmm,
and getting money.
Yeah, this other township you mentioned, I know the licensing, and it has come up here too, council, but we also know that there are at least 100 we've heard from that area that are going under the cover, that they're not licensed,
oh,
and
I'm
yet
sure
they're still operating.
I'm sure there is that. If they're
well
behaved,
yeah,
it doesn't raise anywhere, right? But having said that about the commercial versus residential, I don't know that in the other township those are actually having to, they're not changing their zoning. They're simply getting basically a permit to operate a short-term rental out of their cottage. I'm not aware, and I will double check, but as far as I know, there is no change in zoning to these properties. It's simply that while you're in ownership and you intend to rent it out as a short-term rental, we are giving you permission, and you have to pay us a fee every year, and you have to follow some guidelines to make sure that everything is safe and whatever else, right? So there's no actual change in zoning in those cases, as far as I know.
This is something we've stuck with because of our planner and also our former CBO. They argued that it was a commercial use. So this is why we've stuck with it, haven't gone the other way of the other municipalities and
right,
say, look,
right,
well, you can do what you want with your residential, as long as you get a license. So we haven't done that yet.
Mm-hmm.
We really haven't discussed it to any great extent. It's great to hear that you're saying that there aren't as many complaints as we've had in the past. So.
Not as many as I expected, honestly, because I was at one of the council meetings, I want to say at least a year and a half ago, so long before I took this position, and there was quite a bit of heated discussion around short-term rentals. So when I took this on, I thought, well, this is definitely going to be something that I'm going to look at, you know, on a regular basis, and honestly, it just hasn't been. Matter of fact, I think it's one of the categories I have in my report, if I'm not mistaken. Let's see here. And I can tell you for sure, one of them was just asking, what are the rules? I'm thinking of buying a property. Can I have one? And that's where I explained that, well, no, legally you cannot. So that's not a lot of inquiries. So I again, if council would like, I can certainly see about a proposal for a bylaw that would manage that. And you can have a look at it and see whether you want to go with that or make it mess amendment or leave it off completely. I'll take direction from you.
Okay, great.
Councilor Peckham? I see you have a category here for fencing.
Mm-hmm.
So there is the Line Fences Act that provides a little bit of ability for the municipality to sort of deal with two different types of situations.
Okay.
So maybe just take a quick
peek
at that.
Yeah, I'll do that. Sure.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah, because we currently don't have a bylaw to actually manage height or location or any of that, but yeah, I'll take a look at that. Thank you.
Okay, any further questions? Well, thanks very much. I appreciate
okay.
the report and for you coming in person to present
yeah.
it. That's great.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Great.
Thanks, Chris.
Thank you.
Thanks. Call a question. All those in favor? None opposed? Carried. Remember the resolution.
Accept her report or something like that, right?
Something like that. Now we're on to 11.1. We have resolution 25-445, moved by Councillor Kekkonen, second by Councillor Ryland. Be resolved, the Council of the Corporation of the Township of McKellar hereby receives a deputation from Diane, could be Savage or Savage, I'm sure she'll tell us, of Intact Public Entities, Inc., regarding the benefits of cybersecurity insurance and the associated coverage options available to the Township. And further, the Council directs the Treasurer to proceed with securing cybersecurity insurance coverage for the Township in the amount of $5 million at an annual premium of $12,500 plus applicable taxes. So, Ms. Savage, or Savage, I'll turn it over to you. It's not saying we haven't voted on this yet, so you haven't convinced us that we're going to do it, but it's all yours.
Great. Thank you very much.
She was slideshow.
You can see my screen. You can hear me okay?
Yes.
Great. All right. Good evening. My name is Diane Savage, and I work for Intact Public Entities as a casualty specialist, and I've been with the company for about 17 years now. I was asked to come and speak to you about cyber insurance to help you get a better understanding of what it's about. Why is there a need for cyber insurance? Well, in today's society, cyber attacks on municipalities are on the rise. In the past 5 years, the Canadian Centre for Cybersecurity is aware of over 100 target attacks since 2020. As the saying goes, it's not if, but when. The nature of municipal operations means you handle large volumes of valuable, sensitive data and control services that are critical to daily life. You have rich data environment. Municipalities store sensitive data, including resident information, financial records, tax data, and public safety information. And this makes them enticing targets for data theft and fraud. You also have critical infrastructure. Cyber criminals know that attacks on essential services like emergency dispatch, public transit, and utilities will put immense pressure, public pressure, on officials to pay a ransom quickly. The increasing use of internet-connected operational technology and smart systems expands the cyber threat surface, making you more vulnerable. Dependency on digital platforms and connected services to deliver public services creates more opportunities for cyber criminals to cause service disruptions. Many municipalities still rely on outdated hardware and legacy softwares that is difficult to update, patch, or secure. Older systems often have known security flaws and are not compatible with modern security features. This is especially dangerous when these outdated systems control critical infrastructure like water and energy networks. The purchase for digital information and new online services, especially since COVID-19 pandemic, has expanded the municipal tax service, creating new vulnerabilities. Cyber criminals often target municipalities because they know many operate with limited resources and small IT teams, making robust security a challenge. While cybersecurity may be a priority, a significant number of municipalities lack the necessary funding to implement comprehensive defense strategies. The competitive market for cybersecurity professionals puts smaller municipalities at a disadvantage, leaving them with limited in-house expertise. The people and processes within the municipality can be a significant weak spot. Municipal employees and staff are frequently targeted with social engineering attacks, such as phishing emails, to gain unauthorized access. A general lack of cybersecurity training leaves employees unprepared to identify and report potential threats, and human error is often a primary cause of breaches. Many municipalities lack sufficient information security policies, robust access control, or weak oversight of third parties. Now that we understand why municipalities are at risk for cyber events, I'd like to provide you with a high-level understanding of what cyber coverage is about. The cyber policy is broken into five sections: cyber incident response, cyber crime, system damage and business interruption, network security and privacy liability, and media liability. Cyber incident response provides coverage for the various costs associated with responding to and dealing with a cyber event, such as legal costs, digital forensic costs, crisis communication costs, and privacy breach management costs, just to name a few. Provides costs of initial advice and support in dealing with a cyber event, costs of digital forensic investigations, and removing malware from the computer systems following a cyber event. Provides costs of dealing with PR fallout from an event, including costs of hiring a crisis communication consultant to provide advice. It also provides costs of printing and posting privacy breach notifications, as well as other associated costs, as providing credit monitoring to affected individuals. And it also provides cover for the cost of legal advice in relation to a cyber event, especially with respect to any privacy breach notification obligations. Cyber crime provides coverage for losses associated with the range of cyber crime, primarily focusing on the theft of electronic funds through various techniques. It also covers costs of reimbursing senior executive officers for the theft of their personal funds and losses associated with identity theft resulting from breach of the company's network security. An example of this would be a fraudster who impersonates your CEO and gets a member of your finance team to send a payment over to a fraudulent bank account. Cyber extortion provides cover for paying a ransom demand if you face a cyber extortion incident, and includes expenses for handling the extortion situation, buying cryptocurrency, and negotiating the ransom. System damage and business interruption covers the costs associated with damage to computer systems and business interruption losses caused by cyber events. It includes coverage for costs associated with reconstituting your computer systems to the position that they were in prior to the cyber event, including the cost of recreating data from scratch. Coverage is available for the cost of replacing computer hardware, which includes operational technology, if a cyber event renders it unusable, and when it's more cost effective than reinstalling firmware or software. It also covers the cost of purchasing temporary hardware needed to help recover your systems or data following an event. Network security and privacy liability provides cover for liability claims made or regulatory actions taken against the municipality as a result of a cyber event. It covers any damages that are required to pay as a result of a cyber event that is discovered that impacts a third party, such as malware spreading to a third party's computer systems. This also covers the insurance senior executive officers, including their chief information officer, for any sum they become legally obligated to pay as a result of a cyber event. This also includes defense costs. Media liability provides coverage for any damages the insured is required to pay as a result of defamation or intellectual property rights infringement stemming from the insured's media content. Media content is broadly defined and includes both online and offline content and content created by artificial intelligence. Now that we're familiar with the cyber policy, I'd like to go into a few claims examples to help put this all in perspective. The city of Hamilton attack crippled their systems by disabling roughly 80% of their network. The root cause of the attack was not all departments were using multi-factor authentication, or what's called MFA. The attackers launched a complex ransomware attack through an external internet-facing server. After covertly studying the city's systems, they encrypted their systems and data to render them unusable and attempted, but luckily failed, to destroy all the city's backups. Unfortunately for the city, they were just about to implement MFA across all departments when the attack happened. The ransom demand was 18.3 million Canadian in exchange for a decryption key. They decided not to pay the ransom and decided to rebuild their systems. It has taken the city months to get all the systems back up and running, and there are a few that were unrecoverable. The city will continue to pay nearly $400,000 a month until November 2026 to rebuild their systems. The town of St. Mary's cyber attack saw files and servers encrypted, an attack that involved the notorious ransom LockBit 3.0. The ransom demand was $200,000 in Bitcoin, and the town paid nearly $300,000 to obtain decryption keys. The decision to pay the demand came from recommendation from the security experts dealing with the incident. The ransomware attack first came to the attention of the town's IT staff on July 20th, 2022, as they were conducting a routine system backup. Staff quickly disconnected all servers, which helped prevent further systems from being impacted. Because of the quick actions of the IT staff, the ransomware did not fully encrypt all the town's systems. The town is also fortunate that the critical services like fire, police, transit, and water, wastewater were not impacted due to the decision in 2020 to begin migrating the town's operating environment to the cloud. To date, this has cost the town $1.3 million. The town of Huntsville cyber attack happened on March 10, 2024. An unauthorized user infiltrated the town's system and data was compromised. The town temporarily brought their systems offline as a precautionary measure. The municipal office was closed down for at least a couple of days and meetings were rescheduled to allow the specialists to investigate the cybersecurity issue that came to light over the weekend. It took the town over a month to recover all but one internal system, but some services were still impacted due to some documents that were not accessible. In summary, cyber attacks on municipalities are increasing. Attacks are becoming more sophisticated and disruptive. attacks disrupt essential services and infrastructure. Municipalities must assess vulnerabilities and invest in both insurance and cybersecurity infrastructure. Cyber insurance is a vital tool for municipalities to mitigate financial and operational risks associated with cyber threats. It's no longer a question of if, but when a municipality will be targeted. Thank you for inviting me to your meeting this evening to talk about cyber assurance, and I hope you've found this evening's presentation informative.
Okay, thank you very much. Any questions from council? I'm just interested to know, it's a hypothetical and you probably can't answer it right now, but I don't know whether any insurance companies were involved with Hamilton, St. Mary's, or Huntsville, but what would have been covered? Like, even in your presentation, we're paying our premium here of $12,500, and a lot of things are being covered, but not to any extent. Would that be 100% coverage of those things you mentioned?
Well, the city of Hamilton, the articles that I was reading, their claim was actually denied. Because they didn't have MFA implemented, and they did have a clause in their cyber policy that they must have that implemented for coverage. So unfortunately, they were completely out on that one. I believe on the other ones, they probably did have coverage of some sort, probably for like legal costs. If you have to deal with reporting to a regulatory body, those costs are part of the coverage. If you have to notify someone that their information has been breached, those notices are covered. And then just all the IT personnel that has to be used to find out what happened. If you did have a breach, they have all these IT staff that will go and they do the forensics and look into your systems to see what happened, and they'll help you stop the attack and help you get back to where you were. They'll restore hardware, they will store all your data, restore software. So there's coverage there, it just don't really see it.
I appreciate that. I just was trying to get some figures. Is it 100% coverage of those various things that your company would do, or is there a percentage, and how is that broken down? Because we have nothing in front of us for except an invoice if we go with it. So we're not sure that it's 100% coverage of all those things that you would do.
Yeah, anything that I've discussed, there's coverage there. Some of it may be sublimated. It may be only like $250,000 instead of like a $1 or $2 million for like the cyber incident response. That would be at about $2 million. You'd have a limit of $2 million or whatever the policy that you bought. Typically, it's $1 or $2 million. And other things, smaller things like telephone fraud, it's limited to $250,000.
So, as you're saying, but where's the policy so we can read the fine print? Then we know if it's 100% or how much on each thing, on legal and on different things that you've listed here, but we don't have a policy. We just actually have the amount of $5 million. With a premium of $12,500 plus taxes a year. So, like, what are we giving you that money for? In most insurance companies, you get a policy that you can look at and read.
Yeah, we can for sure get that over to you. There should have been, normally when we send a quote, it does lay out all the coverages and what all the limits are. But then I can definitely get you over a copy of the wording if you wanted to look at it so you can see what the coverage is about.
Yeah, that'd be appreciated.
Councillor
Kekka? So yes, when we do receive the policy, if we could forward that to our IT provider just so that they can review the terms and conditions to determine if there's any clauses that would deny coverage of any precautions that need to be in place that we don't have in place, so we can fully understand what will be covered and if there is items that we don't have in place that basically void the entire policy, well, it doesn't make sense to have the policy, so.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I can get that over to your CEO or whoever handles that. I can get it over to you.
Thank you.
Carly, has she been in touch with you, or is that to Roshan?
It's both through Roshan and myself. I just forwarded council the more detailed quote, but I can't speak to our IT provider. As Diane mentioned, two-factor authentication. We do have it on some of our systems, but not all of them, so we'd have to take a deeper look into what IT requirements we would need to fulfill the policy obligations.
Any other questions from council? I'm sensing a deferral here until we get more information, but I don't want to jump into that. Like, I'm just wondering, too, whether the how long this figure is in play, the 12,500. How much time do we have to make a decision after we receive the policy?
I have to take a look to see how long ago it was that I sent over the quote. They're normally only valid for about 30 days, but I can go back to our companies and just get it refreshed, and typically they won't change the premium at all. They'll just extend the terms for another 30 days.
Okay, that sounds positive. I'll put it out to council again. Any final questions? And we'll do a vote on this resolution that I read earlier. And it's Councillor Kekkonen, so are you going for a deferral, or do we get more information?
Yeah, absolutely. We need to defer and have the IT provider as well review the clauses and ensure that there aren't any factors that would void the or deny any claims. So,
okay, I'll put the question out to council and all those for deferral. And that's deferral carried. Well, thanks very much for your presentation. We appreciate that, and look forward to more information arriving. And we'll try to reach that 30-day deadline, or maybe 60, whatever it is.
For sure.
Thank
yeah.
you.
You're
thanks.
Welcome, and I'll get that information over to you tomorrow.
Okay, great. Thank you.
You're welcome. Have a good night.
Down to 14.1, we have resolution 25-446, moved by Councillor Zulak, second by Councillor Haskam. Be resolved, the Council of the Corporation of the Township of McKellar does hereby approve the minutes of the October 7th, 2025 regular meeting of Council as circulated. Any discussion of those minutes? Call the question. All those in favor? None opposed? Carried. To 15.1, planning, consent application B18/2025, Bastiansen. And they're present, I think, so they'll be able to speak to this as well, and hopefully I'm pronouncing the name correctly. We have resolution 25-447, moved by Councillor Ryland, second by Councillor Kekkonen. Be resolved that Council of the Corporation of the Township of McKellar does hereby receive the proposed consent application number B18/2025, Bastiansen, to create three new waterfront lots, fronting on Ryan Lake and part of Lot 22, Concession 13, Township of McKellar, is applied for by Virginia Bastiansen in application number B18/2025, McKellar, be approved subject to the following conditions. Number one, payment of a fee in lieu of parkland is required in the Township of McKellar fee bylaw. Number two, that the applicant enter into a 5126 agreement to implement the recommendations of the Fry Corps Ecological Services Memorandum dated September 25th, 2025. Three, that the severed lot be rezoned to the, severed lot one be rezoned to the rural RU zone. Four, 911 addressing for the proposed new lots. And five, payment of any applicable planning board fees. Before I open it up for discussion, I think we have Patrick online here to explain the application.
Good evening, Mayor and Council. I'm here. This application by Virginia Bastiansen is, as you mentioned, for the creation of three new waterfront lots on Ryan Lake. I suppose this application is similar to the Greenwood application that we saw before. The only real difference is this is an existing waterfront lot that has a right-of-way water's edge trail running through it that will provide access to the proposed water access waterfront lots. And as you mentioned also, the applicants have hired FRI Ecological Services to address any mitigation from impacts to Ryan Lake in response to the policies in the official plan. Additionally, because of the proximity to a small farming operation, minimum distance separation was conducted, again, similar to the Greenwood application, to ensure that a building site would be available within or outside of the 108-meter influence area that came from the minimum distance separation calculation. And I believe that the separate lot one will have a suitable building location outside of that distance. The owners have also contacted the North Bay Mattawa Conservation Authority and have been assured that septic system locations are available on the proposed lots. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Patrick. Questions from council? I had a couple. I'm just interested in your report, Patrick. You talked about three waterfront lots, and yet the application looks like the two severances, and the third severance is not on water. So I'm counting two waterfront lots, not three. And even through the application, it talks about two severed lots and a retained. I just wanted clarification. Is the retained, it would seem a little unusual, but is the retained one of the waterfront, and yet it's not being severed, it's actually retained? So I'm a little confused on the three waterfront lots. Usually that references what's being severed. It usually refers to three waterfront lots and a retained. And this seems a bit confusing here.
I believe I can answer that, Mr. Mayor. The labeling of the severance is really simply the benefit of the applicants. The severed lot, so if we think of this as an existing road front lot now, which it is, as it has frontage on Balsam Road, you can build on that lot as it stands now. So we have an existing road front lot that also has water frontage. And so the reason that the larger waterfront lot is labeled retained is that the owners are only required to survey the severed lots. So the retained lot is the larger of the three. And so the three severed lots will get a part on reference plan and a certificate stamped by myself at the end of the process. So really the labeling is only so that the larger portion would not need to be surveyed, but would be the remainder. I hope that's clear.
It's clear. I can understand why I'm trying to save some money here, but it's just a bit confusing, that's all, when you say three waterfront lots, and one of the severed pieces is actually going to be rezoned to rural, and that's one of the severed pieces. And yet, in the report, I'm just not sure that's clear. I can see why it's being done this way, certainly, and I appreciate that, and we certainly don't want to halt any development, but just wanted things clarified. The same with the rural lot, that's to be rural anyway. In your report, this is on page 3, you've got the rural zone requirements. and yet for two of the severed, that'd be waterfront requirements, not rural. And also the severed one, it says their frontage is 46 meters, and yet the requirement is 60 meters. So I'm a little confused there on whether it's meeting the requirement for the rural zone for severed one.
The severed one is the existing frontage. So if you think of it as an existing road front lot, it has a road frontage now as it exists. I can understand the confusion, absolutely, Mr. Mayor. And I should not have the rural zone requirements. There should be the waterfront requirements, absolutely.
It has frontage, yes, but I'm just wondering, looking at the diagram, where's the actual frontage on Balsam? That's your basic by the road, right? Balsam Road? Or are you kind of the other?
That is correct, yes.
Okay. So if it only has 46 meters of Balsam Road, that's really not meeting the 60 meter requirement.
I think what Patrick's saying is that it's existing.
But it's now being created, though, as a separate lot. So it exists as one big lot, yes. And you go by waterfront, since it's all waterfront. That's what you base it on, if it's waterfront and road. But because now this is going to be a rural lot, it's totally separate from the waterfront requirement. So you have to go by the rural requirement. It exists as one big lot, you're right.
But yeah, I'm just saying that the presently their whole lot only has the 46 meters of frontage.
That doesn't matter because it's on water. It's waterfront that takes the precedence?
Right, but I guess that's kind of why that the severed lot one is only the 46, because that's all they have, right?
Right, and that's what council has to make a call on, because a requirement is 60 meters, and this is why, you know, that's a design that they've come up with, but is this the only design or the best design? And we've run into this before, if we don't have the proper frontage. There were rural lots, if you recall, on Center Road and other places. They were denied, so I didn't want that to happen, but we have to make sure that the design is correct. Whether Patrick has any comment on that one? Or
I truly don't, Mr. Mayor. The only way to change the design, I think, would either be to give water frontage to the piece that's on the road, or to give some, I guess, status to the private road, which of course isn't really ideal.
Yeah, I don't know whether this was back to a surveyor or not, but just one thing that you'd mentioned there, giving water frontage to that severed one, that would affect obviously severed two and three, and also the retained. They should probably have to move lines over. But that would take care of the problem on the road frontage on Balsam, because that would no longer be applicable if it's actually on water. But that would be a redesign.
It would. I'm mulling over the idea of if that sever one was called retained, that lot as it is could get a building permit based on its existing status as a lot of record. And in fact, that I believe that the very small rectangle on Balsam Road used to be its own lot in the past. It could actually have some status on that way, but obviously too small to meet current standards or any standards now. So the location of the back line of proposed server one was more to give enough area to be sure that you'd have proper building envelope and septic envelope. But
so yeah.
Definitely using the existing road frontage as its frontage.
So is that a possibility of severed one being called a retain?
believe so, yes, because then we would have, we would still have three waterfront lots with access through the retained.
Yes. That might be the solution. Speaking of access, I'm just interested here. Now, that's a private road, Water's Edge. And I noticed in our, I think we talked about it before, in our resolution, we, for this 5126 agreement, it doesn't mention anything about the private road, but I think it should. It just talks about the Fry Corps study that was done. In most of them, of course, we put in too that the township has no obligation, no liability on that private road. So would you again recommend that that be part of our conditions?
I agree, Mr. Mayor, that it's a standard wording to have the indemnification of the municipality or the township for any maintenance and liability for the use of that road. Yes, I agree.
And I suppose that this is something up to the applicants themselves and all of what they have to go through legally. If the retain becomes severed three, then each of those severed lots, 1, 2, and 3, would have access, as you say, over the retained. And I'm just wondering if, I'm really interested in this Water's Edge Road. Does it have ownership right to Balsam, or is there a road allowance that seems to be crossed? I understand that the one road allowance that led to Stewart Lake was closed up, and then there was a new one put in to lead to Stewart Lake in another location. That's why we've got that wavy line moving to the north. But I'm just wondering whether Water's Edge actually owns right to Balsam where it comes down, or whether there's part of a road allowance that it's crossing. And if there is, then I think that should be clarified too, that there should be some type of an agreement with the municipality. Because anytime it crosses a road allowance, that road allowance is public property, and the public can't be denied using that. We've done that on many different properties. Another one's coming up tonight, actually. So I'm just not sure of the actual lines here of ownership, and I don't know whether that should be clarified.
I believe, Mr. Mayor, there is actually that small rectangle with the corner cut out of it. I believe that does touch Balsam Road north of the road allowance running east-west that you see. So the severed one, or what we may want to call retained, does have frontage, existing frontage of Balsam Road.
It does. I'm just wondering about the existence of the present Water's Edge Trail. Does it actually come out on that triangle that you're talking about, or that different shape? Or does it come out onto the road allowance right now? Is it straight down? Or? It's a very small map we have here, so. If it zigzags over to that 46 meters, then that's fine, but I'm not sure that it does.
I guess basically to make
sure. Just looking forward with my air photo to see where exactly the travel road is.
Yeah, I wouldn't want a situation where they have to move the trail over to meet the 46 meters where it touches Balsam, but if they have to do that, I mean, the alternative is to go across the road allowance if that's what they're doing now, but I'm not sure. Councillor Haskell, you have a point?
Yeah, I guess basically what you're touching on is to ensure that private road through this new severed parcel does have legal access from Balsam Road to all these new parcels. So basically that would have to make sure that happens in the legal descriptions of that private roadway to ensure that they do have legal access all the way in that. As I can see on the drawing here, it shows that indent into that width of that road, so it creates a question. So that's just basically a warning going forward to ensure that they do have that full width all the way.
Well, that's what we talked about before, and I know Patrick had mentioned the Greenwood one, and we ensured that it was not a driveway, it was an actual private road. We want the 20 meters, and most of the way it is 20 meters, but as you say, that little indent there, formed road allowance by the looks of it, if you want to get your 20 meters. So I think what we have to ensure, moving forward again, and this is where, you know, generations to come sort of thing, if these people, we run into this, want to turn this private road into, they want the road assumed by the township, then we'd be looking at certain requirements like 20 meters. And that couldn't be obtained right there the way it is now unless they have some agreement with the township that they're actually using part of the road allowance as their 20 meters. I mean, we run into it in the Fox Farm, if you recall. It was on the road allowance, which they used, and then they veered off the road allowance onto private and then back onto the road allowance. But that was all agreed upon and done legally. This one, I think there'd have to be something written in saying that to get the 20 meters, they're actually using part of the road allowance. Maybe Patrick has a better sketch than we do, but what we're trying to get, I guess, is the 20 meters all the way along Water's Edge Trail, so that for future, any future owners wouldn't have to purchase property, or maybe they couldn't even do it if it was not done now. We want to try to maintain
right.
The 20 meters, yeah.
I'm not exactly sure the status of the road allowance that leads to Stewart Lake, the original road allowance that runs east west, but I thought that I heard in the history of the access in the question mark shape portion that original road allowance may have been closed, or it may not have been. I'm not entirely sure of that. But there may be an ability to get an easement to cross that from Balsam that would maintain 20 meters, and then the public access to the lake. I'm not sure we can, without some agreement, I'm not sure we can really address the width where it juts in. I'm pointing at my own sketch here, but the width of the owner's lands, because the access to Stewart Lake is public, I'm not sure we can really, I mean, we can't, the municipality wouldn't give up any land, but maybe there could be an agreement to cross over that public access road.
It would be good to know the, as you say, the status. The one that you thought might have been stopped up and closed, that's at the very bottom, is it the one that leads straight west?
Yes, I believe it that may have been done maybe exchanged for the access to Stewart Lake. I remember hearing that.
Right.
I'm not sure. Again, I'm not sure of its status exactly, but if it wouldn't have been closed if it led to the lake, unless there was some other access, and that may have been how the question mark shaped access came to be.
Right. No, that makes sense, and that's one of our policies in the official plan, that we keep public access to the public water bodies. Because really, Ryan Lake itself doesn't have public access, and I guess Stewart Lake somewhat the same. So this allowed, since the road allowance went in there, obviously provided public access. Not that people would use it, but the option is there. So I think we'd have to clarify the road allowance that's been moved and has that odd shape leading out to Stewart Lake. Has that been opened up, officially assumed? I don't have the history on that one. Because I see right on top of it, it seems to have a right-of-way over top of that road allowance. Now, it must be a right-of-way for some people in there. But again, I don't have the legislation that shows what the previous council agreed to. But it's just similar to what you're saying there. I mean, some people, it looks like they've got a right-of-way over a road allowance. Just for their own privacy, I guess, and always having access. So the road allowance wouldn't be closed. You're talking an easement, I guess, is similar. But I'm just thinking that there's some legalese, I think, that has to be completed here before we go ahead. And I think the applicants, too, would have to agree that Severed One is going to be the retained. We haven't discussed that, so.
maybe we could ask the applicants, Mr. Mayor, if they're okay with the switching of the label on the sketch.
They're right here. That's great.
Maybe he hasn't been doing much with this, so I'm doing all the talking here. So that could be a possibility, is having the what's labeled on the map as severed lot one could be the retained, and then what's labeled as retained could be severed lot one or three, or however we end up doing that. But I guess the question is, that question mark shaped piece of land, or the right of way there, we basically go over the, like to get to access the other properties at the back, we do go over that right of way now, like use part of it as our laneway. So I guess in the going forward, like you said, if there's some kind of agreement with the municipality and these severed lots, that they would have to cross the municipality and no, like, nothing legally binding you guys to have to clean it or take care of it or anything. I don't know how all that works as far as legalities goes, but I think that's the way it is now, basically. So going forward, I guess that would make the most sense to keep it that way, where part of the laneway actually crosses Water's Edge Trail, the municipality owned part of it. So if that works for you guys, that definitely works for us. So
I think we would have to bring the solicitor in on this to get the actual wording. Patrick, okay.
I'm looking at the pin mapping. Sorry to interrupt you, Mr. Mayor. I'm just looking at the pin mapping here, and I could share my screen if you'd like, but there is a pin that includes the question mark shaped piece that actually goes across Balsam Road that would and includes Water's Edge Trail. And the system here does tell me that the Corporation of the Township of McKellar owns that pin. And so perhaps within the consent agreement, we could include wording with some sort of agreement for the current owners and any new owners of the proposed lots to have an agreement to cross that portion of what appears to be part of the roadhouse that crosses Balsam Road and is part of that question mark shaped access.
Charlie's trying to write what you said there.
Patrick, do you have the pin number there?
I do. 521-27-0771.
Thanks.
Welcome.
Yeah, we just don't want a situation, and this has happened years ago too, where people were using part of public road allowance, and they put up a gate, and then we ran into problems. You'd have to go in and explain to them that this is public and you can't gate it off. And I realize over time too, people tend to use a bit of a road allowance maybe, and nobody knows that it's public, and claim it as their own use sort of thing and keep other people off it. We just want to make sure that it's all, again, legal, that people are aware when they're purchasing these properties or whatever is going to happen. Part of it is municipalities involved, but that's what I wanted to make sure too, that this road allowance is actually the new one that was formed or moved over, that it's been opened. I'm not sure if it's ever been opened, assumed by the municipality. We just need the records on that. Now, because it can be open for a different level of service as well. I mean, most road allowances, if they're not being used, we don't maintain them. But as soon as we open them, then it's subject to maybe a summer maintenance or year-round maintenance, depending on what people are requesting. So we just need to, that's why I say we may have to bring the solicitor in on this to do a little research to see see the status of that road allowance that leads to Stewart Lake. And what the, right, go ahead, yes.
Okay, probably several years, 7 or 8, 9 years ago, I actually called the Works Department. I don't know how much they would know technically of what it is, but yeah, I asked if that road, like the first part of that road would be maintained or could get a load of gravel or two or whatever, and he said, no, the way that road is basically right now is it's owned by McKellar, but it's not like not any responsibility of McKellar to do anything with it. So at that time, yeah, basically, I don't know if you call that an open road or what the actual term is of it, but basically no maintenance at all. So until, if you ever decided you want to do something with it, up until that point, basically no responsibility on your part to do any maintenance or upgrading or anything. So.
Well, that's good to have that background information. So if they're giving you that information, that's good to sort of confirms what we're looking at here. We have situations too, certainly the road allowance can be open. We have the Balsam Trail, for instance. We opened up the road allowance leading from a point in the trail out to Highway 124. We haven't done any maintenance on that or whatever, but the road allowance has been open for public use, so they can actually walk along there legally. And we're responsible, of course, for the liability once it's opened up. And even if it's not open, any road allowance is still liable. Didn't want to talk to the insurance agent earlier. I don't think that's her area of expertise. But in this case, I'm just thinking that, you know, even though we put more wording in here, it's something that it may have to go another step. I'm not sure what Patrick was planning. I know we have a planning board meeting coming up, but I think this has got a few complications in it that have to be straightened out. And I wasn't sure if this application was on your agenda for Monday night.
It is, or I should say it was, Mr. Mayor. It's the things sorted out first, just to be sure. It certainly does appear to me that portion of land that you're speaking of is under the jurisdiction of the township, and so it would probably need the same type of agreement, actually, that's coming up in the next file, to have an agreement for the ability to cross for access, and also the ability to maintain or upgrade that would be in the responsibility of the users, not the responsibility of the township.
Yeah, no, that sounds accurate. Yeah. So I'm not sure what we want to do at this point. We have a couple more clauses we could put in there and then defer it all. Mm-hmm. And I know time is of the essence. You want to get this thing going. But as even as Patrick said, I'm not sure we've got all the answers just yet for Monday night.
Yeah.
Might be too soon.
Yeah, whatever needs to happen, like, we're flexible, so, like,
yeah.
Whatever, you know, whatever you guys have to work out with Patrick and legalities and everything, we're easy going, so if we can make something happen, we'll be happy.
Just to make it right, so you don't have anything, you know, to hit you later. So the wording and everything is right, and you know.
That's right. Yeah.
You know where all the lines
all
are,
the,
where you stand.
All the I's are dotted.
Yeah.
And the T's are crossed. So when these go to other people, there's no question of.
They come back to you and say, "Why isn't that? Why isn't this? I thought it was."
Yeah, and that's
why
I want it too, because we don't want anybody coming back on us after saying we didn't do it right or whatever. So if we can just do it all properly and get it, like even if it takes a little longer, and just make it happen the way it's supposed to happen. So.
Okay, I'll ask Carly's advice on this. I can read the amendments and then defer the whole thing, but we'll have to vote on the amendments first, and then we do a vote on the entire resolution.
Or do you just want to defer the entire thing, and then we'll bring forward the resolution next meeting with the changes that we discussed?
That would be the easiest, I think, right now, rather than going through two steps and just defer the whole without the other clauses in there, but that could be the new application or the new conditions that we...
Yeah, and I can speak to the solicitor and get the clauses a bit more confirmed.
Yeah, I think it'd be a good idea, and I know it's more expensive to talk to a solicitor, but we want to get it correct, and the wording, I think, to actually have the township involved in an agreement over a private road, this is why it's really have to get it correct. precedent that you set. I mean, it has to be done correctly and legally, because there are many people out there on private roads that want them assumed, and we don't normally take that step. And we have some unassumed roads, too, that we're trying to deal with and trying to get them under the township control. So we just want to make sure that this one's done correctly, so we could defer the whole section for now. And then you can talk to Patrick, and certainly we will, and Carly will talk to our solicitor, try to get the wording on that.
Yeah.
Patrick, is that okay to entertain a deferral on this?
That works for me, Mr. Mayor. I think it's a smart decision to take to get it right first time.
Okay, thank you. So if there are no further questions from council, I'll put a question then for a vote on deferral. All those in favor of deferring? Okay, so that's awkward to say it's carried, but it's it's deferred. We're on to 15.2. Patrick's still with us. Good. Have resolution 25-448, moved by Councillor Haskell, second by Councillor Zulak. Be resolved, the Council of the Corporation of the Township of McKellar does hereby receive the proposed consent application number B21/2025 Quinn in the municipality of Whitestone to allow the creation of one new rural lot in Lot 18, Concession 1, 306 Balsam Road, as applied for by Andrew and Cynthia Quinn. Application number B21/2025W of Whitestone, and further that as a condition of the consent, the owners to update the agreement to approve and cross the municipal road allowance with the municipality of Whitestone and the township of McKellar to include the retained lot, and further that the clerk is authorized to work with the applicant to fulfill the required conditions. Okay, Patrick, relying on your history here, you can talk to this one, that's great.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I can. It seems many files that we have are unique. This one is more unique than some. But this property owned by the Quinns is in the municipality of Whitestone, but it is accessed from the township of McKellar on Balsam Road through an existing right-of-way owned by land owned by the Quinns. And there is an existing registered right-of-way to Lot 18, Concession 1, in Whitestone. And there is a hunt camp back on on that lot. And Whitestone is quite unique in that they decided that they wanted to have the ability for the creation of back lots where a can be created on a private road. And in this case, it is a private road, a private right-of-way through the McEwen lands and then on to the municipal road allowance that is half in the jurisdiction of Whitestone, half in the jurisdiction of McKellar. And so there was, at the time of the creation of this right-of-way, there was an agreement to, because the road allowance is under the jurisdiction of the municipalities, there was an agreement with the owners to allow them to not only cross the road allowance, but to improve it with gravel or whatever needed to be done for access. And so in order to facilitate the creation of this new lot, Whitestone and McKellar needed to be asked to amend the agreements that were put in place to add the new lot onto that agreement. I hope that is clear.
Well, that's good. I'm just looking back through the resolutions again, beginning to date some of us. 2008. Like we talked about the 20 meters we usually require, and then that was reduced to 10 meters, and now I see it's reduced to, looks like 30 feet
yeah.
in width. You see, this is one of the problems when you start to make concessions and make it smaller. This was leading to a lot that you can assume would never be severed, but now severances are taking place and development is happening. As you say, Whitestone is allowing development on private roads, maybe anticipating the future problems they might have, I'm not sure. And if the roads don't meet any standard, unless they have private road standards, they may have. But that's why we try to go with the 20 meters to avoid any problems in the future. Now, the trouble is this road allowance, initially, as you say, through with the McEwens, it crossed private property. The only one that really concerns us, I guess, to any great extent, is the fact that the severance is in Whitestone, so that's for them to talk about. It's on the road allowance itself, and that remains the 20 meters. There's no difference there. It's just now it has to extend to the retained and the severed, not just the what used to be the full lot. And I think that's all the reason we get involved. But I'm not sure. You've got the Whitestone one agreed here. Would we have something similar on file for the McKellar for the agreement for the road allowance?
I saw in the historic consent file a resolution supporting it, but I did not find the actual agreement itself.
Right, so that's something, again, I'll put over to staff. We should be looking at, we do have something, but maybe not this detailed. Or this looks like it was done out by a solicitor as well. Carly?
Yeah, I'll have to look in the files to see if I can find it.
I do agree that's something that we should have on file too for any changes to what's happening on the road allowance. And even with maybe Councillor Haskin on snowmobile trails, for instance, if they happen to go through there, we're always letting them know that it is public property. That again, they can't throw up a gate somewhere on the municipal road allowance, even though that's how they're accessing their properties. They don't want other people coming in. And so this is why we try to have an agreement, so that we're not responsible for anything that happens on that section of road allowance, but that they can't block it off.
Yeah, I believe way back when the Snowmobile Club, and this was way back 30 or 40 years ago, when they asked for permission to come across there, that the municipality did allow it, but also stated in the resolution it was still open to anybody being municipal property. The resolution back then, just funny going by the map of where the trail goes, and it's kind of a driveway to another lot in there. It's really hardly on the municipal boundary, but that's a whole other story. It's just the way it goes. You follow the best terrain of the day,
right,
kind of thing. So, but yeah, I kind of understand this whole consent application. Yeah, I'm a little surprised with knowing that from Whitestone, especially you would have, maybe they should have considered if they're going to allow development by right-of-way, that the right-of-way should have been maybe a standard width of 60 feet kind of thing to allow for future expansion or improvements of roads, but that's not the case. So if that's whoever, it's basically, I guess, a purchaser or buyer beware that you are stuck with a 30-foot road allowance for history. And
yeah, it probably stemmed from the fact that the Quinns were getting approvals from the McEwens to go through their property,
mm-hmm.
and the McEwens said, you know, less is better, so we don't want a right-of-way of 66 feet going through here.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get it as narrow as we can. But that was between them. But you're right, that's really not preparing for the future. So Patrick, you've heard the resolution there. Does that cover everything? Well, I guess you made it. So that seems to cover everything that's being required here.
I believe it does, yes.
Okay, so the condition is to update the agreement. We'll leave that with Carly then to do that. You need further discussion on this one? Call the question then. All those in favor? None opposed? Carried. To 16.1, I have resolution 25-449, moved by Councilman Patrick, doesn't have to stay around. Maybe he's gone already. Well, there he is.
Still here. You still here, Mr. Rand?
Okay, I won't say anything about it. You can stick around.
I believe that does it for me, though, Mr. Mayor, if you want to get something on your chest with
it. No, that's fine. Thank you. Glad you could be here. Resolution 25-449, moved by Councilor Keckin, and second by Councilor Ryland. Be resolved, the Council of the Corporation of Township of McKellar does hereby receive the minutes of the September 25th, 2025 meeting of the Township of McKellar Recreation Committee. Discussion of those minutes? Councilor Keckin?
So it mentions this haunted walk in Broadbent. So just wondering, has anyone gone and inspected where this haunted walk through the bush in pitch black is going to take place?
It's being worked on by the local community group kind of thing. So yeah, there's been lots of people on it, and they're prepping it with decorations and all that. So, but it doesn't really fall under the Recreation Committee. That's under the Broadbent Snowbugs kind of thing, that walk. The Trick or Trunk is the Recreation Committee.
It seems to be a combination, because the library is doing a dance at night, and then the Trick or Trunk is recreation.
Yeah.
And then the walk doesn't mention the Broadbent Snowbugs, I don't think. I think it's still under recreation.
And I seen that when they brought out the advertisement, which was done by the Broadbent Snowbugs, that they forgot to put on that was by them. So maybe if some people are assuming it's the Recreation Committee, but no, it's not through the Recreation Committee at all.
Well, this is what we have to clarify to make sure that it isn't, because they're responsible for their own liability, and as far as the township's concerned, that we have no coverage for what's going on a private piece of property. And, as long as the public is aware that it is a private event, that because we don't know who this person is, we've never seen the trail, and we don't know what preparations are being made or anything, and I'm not sure the public is aware of that.
Right, and I'm pretty sure I don't see it here. McKellar Recreation Committee did not pass a resolution that they would be putting on that event. So that's a separate private group.
Okay, are they aware of, I don't know whether you're part of that. So are they aware of the potential liability? Do they have coverage? I don't know much about the group.
I think they probably are aware, but they just want to do activities, in their community, and they're not going to be held back with the threat of there being a problem. A lot of things happen. They are aware that it's probably falls on the property owner's insurance, I would think. That's whether if something happened, that would be the first person named kind of thing. So, but I think they're doing a good job in making sure there's not going to be any issues on it.
Yeah.
It's a new thing, and they'll learn by mistakes if there is any kind of thing. But yeah, it's not recreation.
I was just going to say, would it help if you just took that out of the there? Like, you just put Trick or Trunk, right? Because that's what you are doing, right? The Recreation Trick or Trunk?
Yes, that's right.
Couldn't you do that? Just say trick or trunk on the 4 p.m. October 26th, and just take a Halloween dance. And
we have a meeting Thursday night. We could clarify that at our meeting and have it in the minutes.
That'd be good.
Not part
then it might
of
just
the.
Save us.
Yeah. Okay. We'll do that.
Okay. Any other questions with the minutes? All the questions. All those in favor. On to 17.1. Have resolution 25-450, moved by Councilor Haskin, second by Councilor Zulak. Be resolved, the Council of the Corporation of the Township of McKellar does hereby receive report Cemetery-2025-02, monument repair estimates for Herdville and Lakeview Cemeteries, from Deputy Clerk Mary Smith. Further, the council authorizes staff to proceed with the repair of the monuments listed in the Schedule A of the aforementioned report in 2025, the cost of $2,770 plus plus applicable taxes to be funded from the Perpetual Care Fund. Discussion?
How much money is in the Perpetual Care Fund? Do we have a notion?
78,000?
Yeah.
Okay.
A lot.
Yeah.
Councilor Zilla?
So, like, if next year they want to repair more monuments or put topsoil or whatever, there's plenty of money in there that they can.
Yes.
And so do you know why they just picked these two?
It wasn't really, they weren't really picked. Tom just went out and took pictures of the ones that he felt were needed to be repaired immediately, like sooner than later.
Mm-hmm.
And he did go to Lakeview and Herville. He didn't go out to St. Stephen's at that point. I had just sent the pictures that he sent to me, and Sanderson Monument went through them and mm-hmm. gave us all the estimates. There is a couple at St. Stephen's that I think should be added to this list and that do need to be done this year. But they just gave us what we had sent them at
right.
that time.
Okay. So if they did have time and they could go to St. Stephen's, there is money there for
yes.
it. Okay.
Councilor Keichner?
These definitely should be going to St. Stephen's for several reasons. One, why would we wait for a monument to fall and to break, you know, when they can go and level these monuments and be proactive? And as well, there was a monument that was actually toppled over that may topple over again. So, you know, it was insulting to people when they went to the St. Stephen's open house to see these monuments in such disrepair. So I think because it was one of the ones, and citizens have come into the office and brought this to the attention of staff. So I think St. Stephen's should definitely be on the list as well, because it has been brought to staff's attention. And I can't see why this should be. If the staff don't have a work order formed, the staff were cutting the grass at the cemeteries, they should have one. Every time they go there and they see that a monument is beyond a certain amount of degrees of tilt, it goes on the work order form. If there's a monument that's toppled over, they don't just cut around it. They fill out a work order form to indicate that these monuments are in repair immediately, need of repair immediately. So whatever hasn't been done over the last 10 years, let's get it right now and start moving forward and making sure that we're proactive and not reacting to things years after the events have taken place.
Okay, Councilor Hassan.
When was this work scheduled for? This year, before winter? Or?
We were hoping, yes.
Right. Okay, so
as soon as I get the approval, I'll contact Sanderson.
Right. So I guess if staff can give, as I agree with what Mike is saying, that we should probably give direction that to continue with at all cemeteries, especially the ones that are closest to going over. And I would say continue to make this an ongoing project. Keep lining it up right in the next spring. Just keep going on it, basically.
Yeah, I guess it's a question from what I'm hearing anyway. Can we extend this to include St. Stephen's? And would Sanderson have enough time this fall to actually do the ones that are in worse repair? Do you think they would have more time? I don't know what their work schedule is. How much time do they say they'll need for these? Can they add more to the list?
And yes, we can ask them. I can contact them immediately tomorrow and see what they can get done right away.
So I don't know whether you want a rider on this to give direction, saying that when Sandersons are out here, whether Tom has to take the pictures to them first or whether they can make the call of which one's needed, or how it's done, but and we are running short of time, certainly. I mean, if you add another whole cemetery to their list, they might just say, well, that'll be next year. So I don't know. Councilor Zula.
But not only that, like I had mentioned a few months ago about the cemeteries, and I don't think there's been, over the past like 10 years or whatever, much work done on them. So if Tom could go around to them,
mm-hmm.
you know, when he's checking out the monuments and see where the topsoil is needed and the leveling and gravel put for roadways and, you know, seeded. And then they have a report of what needs to be done on them all, and then they can slowly tick them off.
Yeah.
Because it is terrible that,
and,
you know, the
and,
cemeteries
yeah.
are let go sometimes, you know.
Yeah, and that's what the money's there for.
Yeah,
so. Yeah.
So basically this phase one step, the first phase, but now we're going to prep a phase two, and if they've agreed to do that, let them do that, but let's now prepare another phase of...
The next round.
Yeah, next round,
yep.
And put it to them right away, and if they can fit it in this year, great. If not, well, we've been doing not too much for the last decade, so I'm sure we're good till next spring to continue, if that's the way it is.
Well, it would be simplest with this resolution to go with what we've got and then work on another one.
Yeah.
With the company.
Yeah, I agree.
Yep.
But it might not be done this year, that's all.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, it's iffy this time of year.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You don't
yeah.
know what's going to happen.
It could start turning real wet.
Okay. Sounds like we'll just go with what we have. And then, as you say, Tom, in the meantime, he could be doing that this fall, sort of
mm-hmm.
investigating. Okay, so I'll call a question then. All those prepared? Opposed, carried. On to 17.2. Yeah, resolution 25-451, moved by Councillor Ryland, second by Councillor Keckinen. The result of the Council of the Corporation of the Township of McKellar does hereby receive report FD-2025-11, month-end status updates for September 2025 from Fire Chief Robert Morrison for information purposes. Discussion? Councilor Keckinen?
I think we missed one part of that previous report. It was asking on how to stabilize the one monument that was broken. In
oh,
half.
Yeah.
Boy,
yeah, did we
want
to go with the foundation or the tubes?
Whether we could get a do a lay down one, was it? Was
yeah.
it that one?
A
that's
slower,
an
yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure with, again, it's the people who put it in there, and I know it's perpetual care, and maybe it's a really old one, but to actually change what the people initially had put there, I'm not sure we should be doing that either. Should we sort of restore the way they had it there initially?
So they gave two options.
Even though it's more expensive. But
right.
I'm just saying, without consulting the actual people who put it in the first place, I don't think we should be changing the nature of the headstone and doing a lay down one, as you said.
Yeah, yeah, I agree with your comment.
Yeah, and that's what I wanted to make sure that we had this discussion, because I don't believe that these... headstones that are made of marble or anything that's susceptible to acid should be lying in any position where it's flat faced, because they're already hard enough to read. And so if you're going to put them where they're even more exposed to being, you know, deteriorated by the rain, and so it definitely needs to be the vertical option, which is a little bit more expensive.
Okay, I think we're okay as long as staff is aware of that. So, yeah, that's good. Department report. Probably had something marked up, maybe not. Nope. All the questions then, all those in favor? Not opposed, carried. To 17.4, we've already done 17.3 at the beginning. And resolution 25-452, moved by Councillor Zulak, second by Councillor Haskin. Whereas the Council of the Corporation of the Township of McKellar directed that an expression of interest, EOI, be issued to local, charitable, and nonprofit organizations for the management of the bottle shed located at the Township Transfer Station. Whereas two submissions were received from the Dunamic Snow Riders Snowmobile Club and the McDougal School Parent Council expressing interest in participating. Whereas both organizations have proposed they can maintain the bottle shed in a clean, safe, and organized manner and will utilize proceeds from bottle returns to support community initiatives. Now, therefore, be resolved, the Council of the Corporation of the Township of McKellar hereby approves the Dunamic Snow Rider Snowmobile Club and the McDougal School Parent Council as the participating organizations responsible for the management of the bottle shed at the transfer station in accordance with the following schedule. Dunamic Snowrider Snowmobile Club, January, March, May, July, September, November. And McDougall School Parent Council, February, April, June, August, October, December. And further, that each group shall be responsible for the maintenance, collection, and return of bottles during its assigned months, with all proceeds retained by the group responsible for that period. And further, that this arrangement shall be reviewed by staff should any concerns arise regarding the upkeep, cleanliness, or safety of the bottle shed, or as otherwise directed by council. Discussion? Maybe Carly can speak to it. Okay.
I'm going to add to this report. I just spoke to the Snowmobile Club today, and they are asking to not share the bottle collection group, as they've noticed in the past with other municipalities and organizations and whatnot. It's hard to maintain with multiple groups having responsibility. So if they were to share, they would like to rescind the request. I did not have time to contact the McDougall School to see if they could take on the bottle shed 12 months out of the year, so I would ask for council's deferral on this so that I can contact both groups and get more information from both of them.
It's interesting because I think the McDougall one itself, the application said solely or with another, whereas the Dynamic didn't. And so now that Dynamic wants to do it on their own, yeah, I think we have to defer and check with the McDougall and make sure they can do it all. Because if Dynamic doesn't want to share, if we've got the two groups who went through it properly, then they should have said that up front, and they didn't. So I'm agreeable to deferring and then go back to the McDougall Parent Council, see if they can do it. Other comments? Councilor Haskell, you seem wanting to say something. Go ahead.
Yeah, I don't know if this might have been shooting from the hip, whoever you're talking to from Dynamic, saying that they'll just pull right out if they don't get it all. I think that person should be going back to their club and asking them. So I say defer it, but also communicate with them so that say, okay, no, this is probably going to be a sharing thing. You should take it back to your whoever makes the decisions for that club, see how they feel about it.
I can communicate that to them.
Okay. Because I sort of, the way I look, I think it's a great thing because it's a lot of work for one group to do it all. I was at a discussion for the Dynamic, and they would do it, but they know it's going to be a lot of volunteering. And when I seen it, I thought, well, that's good. You get a break every other month, so I thought it was ideal kind of thing. So I'm just surprised that they, with that opportunity to make some money that's needed, that they would make a statement saying they would just pull right out. I think they need to look at that again.
No, I think it's a good point that this would really represent the whole group, but whoever you talk to, and we don't have it in writing in front of them, I guess it would just sort of a verbal what they said. Yeah, so maybe confirmation, as you say, and take it back to the group. But that, as you say, that's good to defer, then, and we can hold off on any decision. Councilor Tecken?
Well, it's unfortunate that we have to defer it because until recently, it seemed like it was full and overflowing. So if we would have passed this resolution this evening, then we could have switched right into the schedule here, and it could have been emptied ASAP. So can we just call someone from the Dynamic and determine, is this representative? So
unless we start with the McDougall group.
The previous group did just come in last Friday. I'm unsure as to how much they've taken, but they can still take bottles up until November 1st. So there's another opportunity for the current group to clean out what is there. But like I said, they just visited the transfer station this past Friday. And then moving November 1st forward, it's a bit of a slower period. So it's a good transition period, even though no one's taking care of it. And then we'll bring this back on November 4th. And hopefully award it then.
Yeah.
So it's really not that much time without an organization, just 3 days.
So Whispering River is still coming in? And
correct.
Okay.
And they've said they don't want to continue on with that? Is that being confirmed?
I haven't spoken to them directly. I did provide them notice, but they have come in since I provided notice to clean out what they could take. And I did extend the opportunity to them if they wanted to reapply, knowing that there may be multiple groups, that they're more than welcome to.
question for deferral? All those in favor? Deferred it is. None opposed. On to 17.5. Resolution 25-453, moved by Councilor Kapanen, second by Councilor Ryland. Whereas reported that MIN 2025-18, request for proposal 2025-15, real estate services for the sale of municipal property, was presented and discussed at the October 7th, 2025 regular meeting of council. And whereas council wanted to ask questions to the real estate firm, and those answers have been provided to council for review. Now, therefore, be it resolved that council of the corporation of the Township of McKellar does hereby award request for proposal number 2025-15 to Land Max Realty Inc. with a commission rate of 3.5%. Further, that the mayor and clerk be authorized to execute all necessary documents to engage Land Max Realty Inc. in accordance with the township's sale of real property bylaw 2011-24. Discussion? Carly, any comments on that?
Do you want me to summarize the question and answer?
Sure, I guess that'd be good in case everybody didn't see it.
Council had four questions to provide to the realtor. So yes, the commission rate is 3.5% plus HST with no additional fees. Another question relating to their experience selling property in the area, they replied they trade and work all over Ontario. Susan has completed many real estate transactions in the area, such as Cornwall, Napanee, Thunder Bay, Kenora, Windsor, Red Deer Lake, Ontario. She also sold houses and lands in Parry Sound area and GTA, of course. Third question was if the property is sold. If the property is not sold, do we pay anything? She said no. The last question, is the commission rate based on the final sale price or the initial list price? And she confirmed that yes, the commission rate of 3.5% is based on the final sale price.
Okay. So they'll give me, go ahead.
Thanks. I don't know if it's public knowledge or not, but do we know which property she is going to list? Is that public knowledge?
Yes, it's the property at the corner of Craigmore Road Drive and Burnett's Road.
Right,
the
okay.
Waterfront parcel.
And she's going to determine what she thinks is a good selling price?
Correct. So she would come to council with a suggested consideration amount, and then council ultimately will decide on the purchase price.
Oh, sounds good. Can I say it?
No, that's good. That's one of my questions, too. And I had some hesitancy, certainly, as you remember from last time, because the group is not here. They say they're going to join the Parry Sound Real Estate Board. I hope they can. I don't know what the requirements are for them to do that. And then have some local people here who can actually go out and show the property. Because otherwise, it's onerous on their part coming from Toronto each time somebody wants to see it. And they may make a video of it, I don't know, but it wouldn't be much variety on that. I guess it would be showing the shoreline on that, a lot of bush. But and the thing is, with this company, as I said before, it seems to be like they go to people they have on a list, and maybe all real estate agents do, I don't know, like investors. And then they'll approach them first, and then they'll put it out on the market with signage, I suppose, and go from there. And I guess 120 days later, if it doesn't move, then we have to make a decision. And if they've got experience around it, but on their site, I haven't seen too much that they're comparable to what we're offering, but they're mostly high-rises and big investment properties in the city. But if they have operated in other townships and other areas, then I suppose that they can do it. I'm not sure. I guess it's they want to be interested. Maybe they just want to expand what they do. And we do have the assessed value on it, right? Something to go by. But that's so dated now. What is it, 2016 assessed value?
Yes.
Yeah, so who knows. Councilor Kekman?
So that property is right on the main road. So that would be, as soon as the real estate signs went out, then property would almost sell itself. Like it's maybe a little different than having to show a house and going through it and getting, where it confirms that the house is in good condition and it has a septic and it has, what kind of well it has. So it's, I think, a little different on how much time the agent would have to spend if it was way back in the back roads and you have to travel, you know, a couple of kilometers through the bush, yeah, you'd want someone guiding you through that. But it has a pretty good potential selling just because of its location, I would think.
And I don't know whether it's ever been surveyed, probably when the subdivision went in, but whether there'd be any stakes here now either. That's the question people would have. How far does the land extend? And if they can't find stakes, that's a concern. That's something the agent would have to maybe come to the office for. We may have more expense yet to show what the actual property is, and if we don't have a survey, it creates a bit of an expense for us. But because you certainly don't want to infringe on other people who live back in Craigmore, and they may have boundaries, but if their property's been there for a long period of time too, that might be hard to find the stakes. Councillor Zulak.
Well, in the end, we have the ultimate say whether we want to sell it or not.
Oh, yes.
So, we don't really have any other option. We have the one where we can do it ourselves, but that's not open and transparent, right? So, I don't see why we can't go with this.
Well, it is open and transparent the other way. It's just that it doesn't reach as many people, that's all.
Yeah. Well, then, too, people might say, oh, yeah, you're selling it yourself, you know, have you got people in mind that you want to sell it to, or something like that, whereas when it's with a real estate agent.
Yeah, you just have to, again, be careful in the situation. Once it's actually listed for a certain price, and you say no to it, then you might be in different...
But we get to decide whether we want that price or not.
Right, that's
right.
The key.
Yes.
And if somebody comes in at that price, then it's a little late for you to be saying, oh, well, we don't like that, we want more.
No, but my understanding is when they tell us what they want to list it for, we have the opportunity to say yes or no, right?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm just saying, be aware that once the price goes on,
that's
pretty well what you're...
Unless
you get into a bidding
war. Sell it at a given price. I mean, if we listed it at $250,000 and we think we can get $500,000, somebody can come in with an offer of $300,000, we don't have to accept it, right? That's consistent with all real estate in Ontario.
It is, but again, just be cautious of the legalese. If you offer for a certain price and then you don't sell it for that price, I know there are bidding wars now you can get into, but we'll see what they come up with.
Yeah.
We just see what happens.
And the other question in that, I think on that particular one, I don't know whether we researched it yet or not, that would have been land that was part of the subdivision agreement whenever that went in the 50s or 60s. So it would be used for parkland purposes, but I think that's our purpose of using that property anyway. So that's where the money would go. So
yeah, and there,
unlike the other ones on 152.
Mm-hmm. And there is another waterfront, municipal waterfront property on that subdivision.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So if we sold it, if we did sell it, that money goes towards the parkland?
Yes.
Good. Okay. Yeah.
That's kind of the idea, to improve some of the other, some areas in the township.
Oh, that's great.